Accession number 4600, Reel 1.
Flight Lieutenant Townsend, Reel 1. When did you join the RAF, Flight Lieutenant Townsend?
In January 1930, straight from school.
Why did you decide to join?
It's a question I've often asked myself ever since, but one thing is I was very keen on radio. I was a very early wireless amateur, used to make construct sets and so on. And also we had an airfield at Woodley near Reading where I lived, and I used to go out there every possible opportunity having a look at airplanes. And the two things together led me towards the Royal Air Force, and I got a copy of Air Ministry pamphlet number 15, and that was it. I applied. My parents were a little bit bothered about it, but I can remember my mother taking me to Reading School to see the headmaster, and his opinion was that, well, if you only had one son, Mrs. Townsend, I would advise against it, but as you have several, then by all means let him go.
This was because the RAF had a reputation for being a dangerous profession, was it?
Yes, it was. Obviously it was relatively dangerous at the time, but as it turned out, of course, much more dangerous in civilian eyes than really it was in actual fact.
Did you know about much about the promotion prospects in the RAF before you joined?
No, absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing at all. So I think it was mentioned in the Air Ministry pamphlet, but you know, when you're looking ahead from the age of 17, as I was then, 12-year service seems to be a heck of a long time away, and 24 years, much more than twice as far. And just what was in the future, really, one doesn't awfully bother about it at that sort of age.
What was the reputation of the RAF at that time, apart from the fact that it was not considered to be entirely safe?
There was very little opinion about it in the circles in which I moved. We knew that there was a Royal Air Force, but beyond that, no one seemed to know very much about it.
How did its reputation compare with that of the Army or the Navy, for example?
I think it was regarded more as a technical service from all angles, and possibly rather more glamour attached to it than foot slogging or going to sea.
When you'd heard that you'd been accepted for the service, what happened to you next?
Well, I was then called to RAF Halton, where all the apprentices went. Obviously, I joined as an apprentice, and I only applied for an apprenticeship with a view to getting some more technical training. And I was called to RAF Halton, where we all gathered for 1 week. And then the signals people, myself among them, were put on a train for Cranwell, where the electrical and wireless school had just moved from Clarendon.
What happened to you during the week at Halton?
The most outstanding thing, I think, was the haircut. That really was a very short back and sides. And a very stiff medical, which lasted for, I think, a whole day. And the other vivid memory I have is of one very friendly flight sergeant who used to make model aeroplanes and showed us how an aerofoil worked by flipping it through the air. Otherwise, it was just all very strange. And those are the outstanding memories I have of it.
Was it easy to get accepted for signals work in the RAF?
I think they were taking the the top of the entry exam to give them the choice that they asked for. Obviously, we were asked a stated choice, and my only preference was for signals. I was just interested in the radio side. And I did, in fact, take the entrance examination, although I found out afterwards that with the school certificate I needn't have done. But I came out 42nd in the country, so I stood fairly well for getting a choice of my trade.
You said that after Halton you went to Cranwell. What were your impressions when you arrived there?
Very difficult to say. I'd had some OTC training at school, and this seemed to pick me out a bit at first to take charge of the squad and so on. And my really big impression of Cranwell was on the first morning when I heard that there was a band on parade. I've always been musically inclined, and the fact that there was a band on my station went down very well indeed, and I determined to join it, which I did as soon as possible.
Was it easy to join?
Oh yes, very easy. Too easy, in fact, in a way. I went along to the band room. I found out where the band room was and went along and saw the bandmaster. Now, he had a professional bandmaster, a Sergeant Follett, and he had no instrument spare at the time to let me have, but he said, fair enough, you just come along here morning after morning and I'll find you something to do. And I found after the first morning that this duty was to clean his bicycle, and until an instrument came spare, which it eventually did, and this was a trombone. So I learned to play the trombone. He just pushed an instrument and a tutor into my hands and said, go and learn that. You can read music. Off you go. And so I sat down and in the band room, of course, and learned to play the trombone.
Did you resent having to perform this personal service for him?
No, not really, because I mean, quite frankly, one at that time was very much screwed down by NCOs, and anything you could do for a little favour from an NCO was something to be sought after.
Because it released that amount of pressure from you, you mean?
Yes, yes, that's right. I shall never forget the phrase in the Air Ministry Pamphlet 15, which talked about, quote, specially selected NCOs. And some of them were extremely good. They really were absolutely first class. And, as men, they were to be admired. But there were one or two who, I suppose, crept in. You can't avoid a small proportion who are not all that good. And there were one or two who were distinctly shouldn't have been there. But nevertheless, they were, and we had to live with them. But please don't interpret any of that as applying to the bandmaster. He was a good bandmaster, and I liked him, and I certainly never resented having to clean his bike.
Can you describe the setup at Cranwell? This wasn't the Officers' Training College section of Cranwell, was it?
Oh no, that was at West Camp. We were at East Camp, which was the Electrical and Wireless School, period. And there were two sides to that. One was the training for airmen, in other words, chaps over 18, and the training for apprentices. And the apprentices, of course, were kept very separate. And we formed a squadron called A Squadron, and there were eight flights in A Squadron. I was in number four flight. And we were right at one end of the school and kept very distinct.
Did each flight have a distinctive mark on their uniform?
No. No, just a number of the flight, that's all. We all wore red cap bands, to distinguish us as apprentices, and that was the only other distinguishing mark, except for the wheel, the spoked wheel, which we wore on our right arm, in brass, of course, so that we could polish it.
Was there a great deal of bull there?
Oh, yes. Yes, there was. There was a lot. Like, for example, one never walked on the floor in one's dormitory. You walked around on floor pads, bits of old blanket, because Friday night was the bull night, and for the CO's inspection on Saturday morning. And to avoid having to do a lot of work on the floor, one just walked around on floor pads as soon as you got in the door, and that was it.
Were these attached to your feet or scattered about the floor?
Just around on the floor, and you grabbed a couple of them and walked, shuffled along the floor on them. And the kit had to be laid out every morning in a particular fashion. We had the old MacDonald beds, which shoved up inside to make a so-called armchair. And our mattresses were things called biscuits. In other words, the mattress was in three bits. Biscuits stuffed with something pretty hard and lumpy. I'm not sure what it was. But we were young and we slept and we were healthy and we slept and that was it. We were certainly not overfed. There was no question of going to bed on a full stomach or anything like that. Our last meal was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, called tea. And I can so well remember that if we could get hold of just a slice of bread and an extra piece of margarine, then we were delighted. The money on which we were fed was 9 pence per head per day.
How did you know that?
Oh, I don't know. It's the sort of information that got around. We knew from clerks and so on that we talked to that it was 9 pence a day.
So you felt that the quantity really wasn't adequate?
Oh, no. Well, I say no, it wasn't. And yet, you see, there we were, all young. We went in between 15 and 17 and a half. 15 and a half and 17, sorry. And so we were all growing. We were very busy. We were turned out for PT at 6:30 in the morning. And the day was pretty hectic from then on until lights out at 9:30. And yet we all grew. We were all quite healthy. Except that if you did have any weakness at all, it found it. And I know in my class, which was called 2D2, I think something like half a dozen fell by the wayside before the 3 years was up. One particular chap I well remember, who slept in a bed almost opposite mine, he was taken ill one night. He was a country lad and he looked as strong as an ox, you know. But he was taken ill one night and off into hospital straight away, and in 24 hours he was dead. Much to our shock. Well, you know, it was a great shock to find that sort of thing happening. But another lad bought himself out. That one died. Oh, several of them were killed, I know. In fact, I'm only in touch, although I try very hard, I'm only in touch now with one chap who was in my class at the time. Obviously there's been a war in between, so an awful lot fell by the wayside then, but I think it was something like 6 out of my class that didn't make the final passing out.
What was wrong with that country boy?
I don't know. We were never told. He was operated. We did learn that he was operated on, but I think he probably had a cancer or something like that, because it was alleged that there was nothing much to operate on, so they just stitched him up and let him die.
You said
I was going to say, this was in spite of a very rigorous medical at Halton when we joined.
You said some were killed. You mean they were killed whilst they were on the course?
They were killed afterwards. I know that one or two killed afterwards in peacetime, not during the war.
Could you describe to me the type of training which you had at Cranwell?
Yes, the first during the first 2 years of the three, we continued our general education, and there was a separate education block and a senior education officer, Ivor B. Hart, and a number of civilian instructors who were all graduates and all very well qualified, it was excellent instruction. The Air Ministry, in fact, recognised this at the end of the 39-45 war, and any of us who had qualified educationally by the end of the 2 years, which meant, in fact, passing the sergeant's educational test, we were given a certificate to say that our education was to higher school certificate standard. So that side of it really was very good indeed. There's a good library, we were encouraged to do things in there. Then the rest of it was split up into subjects. There was a WT block, for example, a wireless block. There were workshops. There were special workshops for soldering and brazing and that sort of thing. Then we had, over on the airfield, we had what were called O-sheds, which were devoted to aircraft wiring instruction. And that was about it. The WT block was the biggest one, of course. That was very well equipped, as far as anything in the service was well equipped with radio at that time. The equipment was all pretty primitive, but such as there was, it was well laid out, and we could really get to grips with it. And some very fine instructors, too.
In what way was the equipment primitive?
Oh, well, if I tell you, for example, that as a boy, I was playing about with umpteen different types of vacuum tubes. I better say vacuum tubes and not valves. But in the service, I found that we only had one type of receiving valve. Every set used this one type of receiving valve, period. And although the RT receiver, for example, the aircraft RT receiver was a 7-valve superheterodyne type, it still had the one type of valve in every position. And I know I came across this one afterwards when I went to 16 Squadron. And to find one that would oscillate in the oscillated position, it meant sitting down in the cockpit with a whole bunch of valves and sticking them in one after the other until you found one that would oscillate. So it was very primitive in that way. Everything, of course, was medium wave. The sets, the little aircraft transmitter was a very simple oscillator amplifier thing. The simple aircraft receiver was a straightforward TRF receiver with, I don't think it had quite swinging coil reaction, but very nearly. That sort of thing, very insensitive, very poor performance. And when I went on to a squadron, using this equipment, I held the WT record at one time with a range of 60 miles, which was fantastic. 60 miles with WT key bashing, not RT. RT, we were lucky. We thought we were lucky if we got 20 miles range.
Was there better equipment on the market at the time?
Oh, yes. There were, for example, the tetrode was in use, in very common use, in fact. as an RF amplifier, and we were using the sets that we built for ourselves in our dormitories and so on were much more advanced than anything the service had, much more so. I don't know why this was, but Farnborough seemed to be very behind the times as far as equipment was concerned.
But did you find that the equipment was adequate for the job?
Well, no. If as I said, 60 miles WT range for an aircraft, it's pretty inadequate. 20 miles for RT is pretty, it's almost useless. And we could have done with a lot more performance. The Army Co-op receiver that we had to work with aircraft was again a very simple set and very inadequate performance. And for gun, it was all right if the aircraft was almost overhead for gun spotting, but obviously the Army had shells that could go, or guns that could fire a heck of a lot further than overhead. So it wasn't all that clever.
Was there any means by which people in your position could put on pressure for better equipment?
Oh God, no. Oh no, no, no. See, the airman those days, or the, particularly the apprentice in those days, was very well screwed down. This is the one criticism I have really to make of the system under which we were trained. We were all reasonably bright lads. Say the entrance qualification was a school certificate, so we certainly weren't illiterate, and I'm convinced myself that a lot more could have been done to bring us along and bring us out of ourselves to really to the benefit of the service. It wasn't until we got away from Cranwell that we found things were completely and utterly different actually on the squadron service than they were at Cranwell.
Let's go on next to how you came to leave Cranwell. Was there a passing out exam?
Oh yes, oh yes. As I've said, firstly there was the educational one at the end of 2 years, and then the trade one at the end of the third year. Now, it so happened that the trade structure was altered slightly towards the end of my 3 years, and I went in to train as a wireless operator mechanic, but the trade was altered. The trade of electrician was dispensed with. The separate Group 1 trade of electrician was dispensed with, and they decided to amalgamate electrician with the wireless operator mechanic and call us wireless and electrical mechanics. Now, that being so, it was considered that our electrical training had been a little bit on the scanty side, and so we passed out firstly as wireless operator mechanics at the proper time, the end of the 3 years, and then we were brought back for another 2 months just to mug up on the electrics, and then passed out again as wireless and electrical mechanics.
Can we go on next to your first posting to Old Sarum? How did that come about? Was it just a posting, or was there any choice for you?
No, it was just a posting. I believe there was some question of a choice, and obviously we all plunked to go as near home as possible, but clearly it couldn't be done because there were chaps from all over the country there as apprentices, which incidentally was one of the very good things about it, because we learned to rub shoulders with other people from other parts of the country. I well remember the Geordies, for example. I'd never come across a Geordie before. But we all plunked to go near home, but very few of us get our choice. Although I didn't do badly. I was at Salisbury and my home was in Reading, which was only 50 miles away, so I had no complaints.
What was the best like at Old Sarum?
Oh, life was completely and utterly different on a squadron. As apprentices, you see, as ex-apprentices by then, we were supposed to have none of the airman's privileges for the first year, as our training was supposed to continue during that time. But also, in return, we were excused station duties such as guards and fire pickets. Now, when we got to Old Sarum, I went down with one of my classmates called Jackie Murrells, and we went in, we were summoned into the station sergeant major, Warrant Officer Bartlett, and he beamed at us, very kindly old gentleman he was, and said, "Now you ex-apprentices, of course, are excused guards and fire pickets and other station duties while you are during your first year. On the other hand, of course, you don't get a late pass and you are not allowed to go out in plain clothes. Now, if you like to come to the little arrangement with me that you don't mind being put down on the roster for guards and fire pickets, then I think we could probably find you a plain clothes pass and you can stay out till midnight every night." So I ask you, what does one say? And anyway, I'm afraid I pulled a bit of a fast one because I accepted his late pass with plain clothes, and then of course went straight round to the band room and made myself known to the bandmaster as a voluntary bandsman, and so I was excused guards and fire pickers anyway.
What were your duties at Old Sarum?
Oh, I was in 16 Squadron in Sea Flight, and my duties were to look after the radio, or to help look after the radio in the three aeroplanes of Sea Flight. It was as simple as that. We had Atlases at the time, Atlas aircraft at the time, and say the same old set that I'd been trained on, and it's a question of keeping them going.
What did the airmen of the time think of the Atlas?
Well, really, we didn't express opinions. To us, it was an aeroplane to be worked upon, and that was it. We didn't think it was a particularly old hat aeroplane or anything like that. It was quite modern for 1933, so why should we grumble?
And did you feel the same about the Audax?
Oh, well, the Audax we considered was a distinct move in the right direction. It was quite a different aeroplane from the Atlas. And, of course, as far as we were concerned, we had to fly in the back cockpit anyway and operate the radio, so which was the more comfortable. The Atlas was very cold, very drafty, and I mentioned the 60-mile WT record, and I can still well remember when I did that, because I had to have my helmet with the headphones on strapped so tight round my chin to squeeze the headphones up against my ears. And I was crouched right down in the aircraft over the key to get out of the slipstream and hear what the devil was going on. And in fact, I made myself sick in the process, but nevertheless, I bust the record, so I was quite happy.